Kevin Barrett, and I walk the line for truth. If you want to help keep these shows on the air, become a subscriber at truthjihad.com. That's truthjihad.com.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. You may be an ambassador to England or France. You might like to gamble. You might like to dance. You might be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls, but you gotta serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you gotta serve somebody. Well, it might be the devil, it might be the Lord, but you gotta serve somebody.
Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Barrett, bringing you great guests to look at things from outside the narrow perspective of the corporate mainstream media. Well, today I'm going to bring on one of my two favorite rabbis. This is Rabbi Michael Lerner. He is perhaps America's best known liberal Jewish pundit. And he has put out a great piece recently, which I think has a lot of promise in terms of getting an interfaith effort going to save the world. His article is called "The Pope Might Save the Planet If You Would Join an Interfaith Effort to Support His Direction." And it concerns the recent encyclical from Pope Francis talking about environmental issues and a whole lot more. It's actually both Rabbi Lerner's piece and, of course, the Pope's piece are very, very interesting and promising. So let's get to it. Welcome, Rabbi Michael Lerner. How are you?
Great. How are you doing?
Doing fine. So it's good to touch bases with you again. You know, we've worked together on two books, 9/11 and American Empire, and we are not Charlie Hebdo dealing with the issues of the war on terror and things like that. But in a sense, those issues are almost pretty minor when you look at the damage that's being done to the planet today, and that may be the overarching issue of our time. I thought you did a good job responding to the Pope's piece. Maybe talk a little bit about how you see the importance of this new encyclical from the Pope.
Well, first of all, we have to recognize that people have inured themselves, have blocked off from their own consciousness the awareness of what's happening to the planet. And it's my view that the reason that people do this is largely out of depression, that is an inner feeling of despair about being able to do anything about the planet. And because of that, they don't want to hear about it. It goes in one ear and out the other ear. It's like, I can't deal with this, so I won't deal with this. It seems so overwhelming, so big an issue, and it is a very big issue. You face increasingly on the planet a depression and denial as people feel the pain of the planet, feel the upset, and then try to escape that pain by closing it off from awareness and proceeding as though it wasn't really happening. And I've seen this happen in other spheres, and I know how just to take a comparable example in some ways, the Jewish communities in Europe managed to deny the danger of the growth of fascism and to try to continue life as normal, imagining that somehow the bad things that were going on in the political sphere would eventually disappear or be repaired. They didn't know how. They didn't have a plan as to how. But they just imagined that the Nazis, the fascists, would eventually dissolve or self-defeat. And so they continued life as usual, and until suddenly they're shipped off to concentration camps and murdered. by the fascists and by the strong anti-Semites amongst the Christian world that used the fascism as an opportunity to act out the hatred that they had felt for a long time against Jews.
Now, do you see a parallel there with the current situation of Muslims, with well over a million Muslims murdered by the so-called war on terror today, and the prospect of another big 9/11 style event that could lead to the same thing happening to Muslims?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's something that Muslims, I'm not saying that the comparable thing would be for Muslims to be in denial about that and to not recognize.
Take it from me. They are
recognize how what a great danger this war on terror is as a kind of blanket assault on anybody who is perceived as fundamentally different and threatening to American power and or more generally to Western capitalist power. But I see the danger very intensely in relationship to the environmental crisis. This crisis is getting worse, not better. It's not going away. It's going to more intensely affect people. Of course, it affects people differentially because it's going to have a greater impact on the poor and the powerless than it will on the rich and the powerful. But it will affect everyone. And the level of denial is intense and the imagination that we can take slow little steps that will, if we put more solar panels on our houses and recycle our garbage, that somehow this will go away, and it won't go away. It's getting worse and worse and worse, because the planet's carrying capacity for garbage that we are creating and the planet's resources that we are exploiting are finite, and yet we have this attitude towards the planet as though it was a bottomless cookie jar that you could reach in and take out as much as you want. And then you could throw away the waste materials in a bottomless pit of bottomless garbage can, and that's just not how it is. It's not true. There are limits. The planet has limits. We've reached those limits. We're straining those limits, and we're all going to be affected by it.
Well, one of the things that was noted by some observers, including the author of a recent New York Times article on the Pope's encyclical, was that the Pope is very forcefully attacking a kind of technocratic management style, which is, of course, pretty much universal today in the power elite, and arguing for something different. We're not quite sure what it is, but it would seem to be a essentially religious worldview, in which, rather than looking at the world as objects, we look at the whole world as fellow subjects, the way St. Francis used to talk to the birds and praise the sun and moon. So there's a spiritual dimension here, too. How did you respond to that?
Well, of course, this connects to the main work that we're doing in the organization we've created called the Interfaith and Secular Humanist Network of Human of Spiritual Progressives, NSP, a Network of Spiritual Progressives. And our network of spiritual progressives doesn't require you to be religious or to be part of a spiritual community. But what it does say is it welcomes people who are secular humanists or who even are militant atheists, but who agree with us in the central thing that defines what a spiritual progressive is, namely our desire for a new bottom line, a new definition of productivity, efficiency, and rationality. You see, in today's world, efficiency, rationality, and productivity are all judged by the degree to which they maximize any activity or any corporation or any social policy maximizes money and power. And what we're saying is, no, those institutions, social policies, corporations, they should all be judged efficient, rational, and productive to the extent that they maximize love and caring kindness and generosity, environmental sensitivity, and enhance our capacity to respond to other human beings as embodiments of the sacred, and enhance our capacity to respond to the universe with awe, wonder, and radical amazement at the grandeur of all that is, rather than looking at the universe or other human beings simply as means to our own ends.
And is that possible? So, yes. Is that possible outside of a traditional religious framework? You mentioned that you have all sorts of people, including atheists and so on, and it seems that the Pope is suggesting that the traditional religious framework needs to be recovered.
Well, I mean, I think that you might say that that what we're talking about in our network of spiritual progressives is recovering the essence of the religious framework, but not requiring you to be into any particular religion or into religion at all. In other words, so I believe it is possible to enhance people's capacities to respond to other human beings as embodiments of the sacred without having to buy into any particular metaphysic, without having to be part of a traditional religious community, particularly since most of the existing religious communities have abandoned what we call our new bottom line, because of the impact of global capitalism in shaping the dynamics within religious communities. So I do believe it's possible to adhere to a new bottom line or a new sense of the sanctity of other human beings, the sanctity of the earth, without necessarily believing in what was traditionally considered to be a god or a religious tradition. On the other hand, since we started the network of spiritual progressives as a vehicle to put forward this kind of worldview and to then develop policies, concrete policies that would manifest this worldview, I have certainly become very aware of the degree of religiophobia in the liberal and progressive world, because there are many, many wonderful people in the liberal and progressive world who share a desire for economic justice and for political rights for everyone, equality, and those important values, but who are reactive against anything that smacks of religion or smacks of spirituality, that they simply turn off and refuse to listen. And I think what the Pope is saying is, look, there's what it's going to take to make a transformation in our relationship to the planet is a consciousness transformation, and that consciousness transformation isn't simply about equality or economic equality or political rights. It's also about a whole different orientation, a non-instrumental orientation towards the physical universe and towards other human beings.
That theoretically makes sense to me, and I have run into some people like those you're talking about, progressives, who are quite religiophobic. In fact, your neighbor in Berkeley, Michael Parenti, was on the show not too long ago expressing a certain degree of religiophobia.
Yes, a lot of it.
Right. I mean, you've probably had the same kind of conversation with him I had. But I've noticed, though, that, I come from a progressive kind of background and then shifted. I came to Islam in 93. I've spent some time in Mexico and Central America and a year plus several other visits to Morocco. And I've noticed that it does seem to me that people who have a strong traditional religious basis are able to have a very rich life, especially a very, very rich social life, in some ways a far richer life than most of the liberal progressive folks back in the rich world, in places like Mexico and Guatemala and Morocco, and they're using vastly fewer resources, so they're having a better life. Even maybe not physically, they're a lot of problems. They're in Morocco, they're losing their teeth from living on sweet mint tea and bread, which is all some of these people can afford. So there are some problems at the material level, but the overall You'd say that the richness of life is vastly greater, it looks like to me, in the traditional impoverished religious communities of the Spanish-speaking South and in places like Morocco. So I wonder whether, you know, and then when I look at the liberal progressive types here in the rich world, they're generally living reasonably well, consuming a lot of resources, not giving very much to charity, even though they're all in favor of high taxes. Whereas here in Wisconsin, some traditional religious folks I know, some, you know, Amish Mennonite types, people like that, they're putting their what little money they have sort of where their mouth is. I know people who spend every half of every year going to Mexico to help poor people, giving a lot to charity and living at a much lower scale socioeconomically. So it seems to me empirically, as I look around the world, that there's a case to be made that without a traditional religious basis, people simply don't have something's missing in their lives that they're just going to tend to try to fill with material goods. So I would, you know, it seems to me that this effort to create a kind of a lifestyle that liberal secularists could actually have a rich life while living very, very low on the material scale is foredoomed. And I think we actually need to go back to a traditional religious basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'll be an agnostic on that question.
Okay.
I myself am, you know, very much, I'm a rabbi and I have a congregation and I pray every day and religiously observe the Sabbath every week, and believe that those are particularly the Sabbath is an amazingly important way of enhancing one's own well-being. So I'm certainly not wanting to say that I'm be put in the category of being against religion. I'm totally immersed in it and believe that it's very healthy for the variants of religion that can recognize the value of other human beings and not triumphalist, not thinking that they've got the only possible approach and that everybody else is wrong and doomed. Those kinds of religious traditions that enhance our capacity to value the other, to see the other as created in the image of God, all of those, I think, are life-saving and badly needed. But there are other variants of religion that are very destructive. So I can't just say religion. I have to specify what variants of religion are the ones that we can endorse and adhere to. And I say I have more in common with people in all religions who value and see the humanity of everyone on the planet, the decency, and see respond to other human beings as embodiments of the sacred, more in common with people in every other religion besides my Jewish religion than I have with some religious Jews who can't see that, some religious Jews who can't see that, some religious Christians who can't see that, some religious Muslims who can't see that, some religious Hindus and Buddhists who can't see the equal value of every other human being, regardless of their religious tradition. So so I don't want to make a general statement about all religions. I want to say that, yeah, there are religions that are humanly and earth nurturing, and there are religions that are not so. And this fault line isn't between one religion and another. It's within each religion. There are these divisions.
That's a very good point. To which I would simply add that sometimes people whose religion may not be all that enlightened are sustained by it in such a way that they're able to lead extremely rich lives using about 1/100th of the resources of everybody where I live here in Wisconsin. So getting back to the Pope's encyclical, there are all sorts of good things in it. I hate to start out with any critiques before we get to all the good things, but one of the things I was struck by was the lack of attention to what I see as one of the real roots of the whole problem, which is the currency system that we now have, in which all of our currency is fiat currency that represents nothing. It's created out of thin air and lent into existence at interest by private parties who are part of a sort of a deep state, a criminal cabal that rules much of the world with no transparency and no accountability. And to me, that's almost the basis of much of the problem, because if you have to pay back every dollar that's created with interest, then you're in a non-sustainable situation where you have to keep growing exponentially. And usury, or riba, as we call it in Islam, it grows exponentially, whereas actual physical wealth and physical processes cannot grow exponentially. And I think that contradiction in our currency system is driving the kind of growth, you know, the cancerous growth model that's destroying the planet. And the Pope didn't really mention that, which is weird, because I thought the Catholics traditionally absolutely banned all forms of lending at interest, as we do in Islam.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know that, I mean, in the Torah, which is the foundation place from out of which the other Abrahamic traditions, Christianity and Islam, developed, it is clear. It forbids taking interest and on loans. It prohibits it. And there are remnants of that consciousness in the Jewish world. In the we have a thing called the Hebrew Free Loan that that gives loans to Jews with no interest whatsoever. On the other hand, when over the course of the centuries, people finding it hard to live in a world in which there was so much commerce that was dependent on loans and interest, some Jews began to reinterpret that command, and because it said, "Don't take interest or don't loan for interest to your fellow," so they reinterpreted that to mean to your Jewish fellow, and to say, "Okay, we are allowed to give loans to non-Jews," and so for interest, and that then led the Christian church, the Catholic Church, said that they wanted to adopt that policy. They then decided the only way they could get around the requirement of no interest was to require Jews to do the loaning of money to Christians, and then they could then engage in the capitalist activity. And put the Jews in the position of being the moneylenders, which was not a good situation for Jews, because since the Catholic Church banned Jewish ownership of land, and so Jews weren't able to do the only other activity that would, and the Jews were kept out of the guilds in the Middle Ages as well as owning land. So moneylending became one of the very few activities that Jews were allowed to do in Christian Europe. And that, of course, created a great deal of hatred towards Jews, because all Jews were seen as moneylenders, even though it was only a tiny, small percentage of Jews. Eventually, the Protestants rebelled against the Catholic law, and they took over the moneylending themselves, because they said, we don't need any of these laws from the Torah. We'll just our way to God is through faith, and we don't have to, not through works, so we don't have to follow the economic policies of the Torah that required sharing and forbade interest. Today, I agree with you that the money system is one part of a total capitalist system that is deeply perverse in the way that it operates, and that it brings out the worst in people, not the best in people.
Oh, very well put. You mentioned there the way that Jews were sort of funneled into taking a disproportionate role in the banking system, which is not as disproportionate now as it once was, as you say, because everybody else, not just the Protestants, but even a lot of Catholics, have stopped worrying about usury. But it seems like they're still, the banksters are still protecting themselves to a certain extent by saying anybody who criticizes the international banksters must be anti-Semitic. That's how Stephen Jones, the scientist who did the work on the controlled demolitions on 9/11, was forced out of Brigham Young University. During a radio show, he was asked who he thought might have been responsible for 9/11. And he said, well, some people say maybe the international bankers. And that was the excuse they used to get him fired or force his retirement from Brigham Young, claiming that the term international bankers is a euphemism for Jews. And that kind of thing is common.
The Nazis used that term as a euphemism for Jews and said that all Jews are part of that. And because they did that and managed to develop, help intensify the already existing anti-Semitism that the Catholic Church had and the Protestant Church both had sustained for such a long time in Europe, it became a kind of watchword for. I mean, it's the same kind of thing as today. The word terrorism is often used as a hidden way of referring to Muslims, and the way that crime is sometimes used as a hidden word to refer to all blacks. So you have to look at the social context and understand why Jews became very sensitive about that charge of being the international bankers, when in fact we weren't. The tiny, 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 tiny percentage of Jews were engaged in international banking, but the population of the world had been stirred to believe that it was all Jews who were involved in that, and that it was only Jews who were involved in it, whereas Jews are not the majority of bankers, and they are not the vast majority of Jews have nothing to do with banking. So I understand how that came about, but if I don't believe that talking about international banking should be ruled out because of that previous reality. But I think that it may take some time for people to have to say, and when I say the international banking elite, I am not referring to Jews. I am referring to people of every religious and ethnic background who are engaged in this activity.
Yes, I think there's a parallel there with Muslims being seen through the prism of, let's say, the House of Saud and Saudi Arabia.
Right. That seems. Without commenting on the specific situation that you're referring to, which I don't know about, I'll just say that it would be wise for people who are talking about international bankers to immediately clarify and say, and I'm not referring to Jews who had in the past been blamed for international banking and who are not the major element in international banking today, although that some of them are still involved in it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and another thing that was seemed to be a little bit missing to a certain extent from the Pope's encyclical was a reference to the role of security in military spending. He talked so much about the technocrats and the way the poor are the first people to lose from the environmental crunch and the social breakdown accompanying it. But he didn't really mention one of the key issues here, which is that we've been increasing military and security spending primarily to protect the haves from the have-nots. And all of that money is money that could have been used to mitigate the environmental problems, to make life better for everyone, especially the poor. And yet we're spending it on these technologies of murder and destruction.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why the network of spiritual progressives, and by the way, people who are listening can look at our website, spiritualprogressives.org, and that we put forward a plan for a global Marshall Plan to not just ameliorate poverty, homelessness, hunger, inadequate education, inadequate health care, to have a domestic and global Marshall Plan to eliminate those things, and funded by dramatic reductions in military spending. And the basic core of that argument in our global Marshall Plan is that to achieve homeland security, the path is not domination, which can be achieved through military power and economic power and manipulation of cultures and so forth. but rather the path is through generosity, through showing genuine caring to other people. That's the path to homeland security. Now, if you put that together with the Environmental and Social Responsibility Amendment to the Constitution, the ESRA, which we have put forward, and you can also find it at spiritualprogressives.org, the details of the Environmental and Social Responsibility Amendment, you'll find a real program for saving the environment, for taking major steps towards saving the environment. So I love what the Pope did, and I believe that, as I started out to say, that his message is going to cut through a lot of the denial that people are in, and that's why it's so important. But at the same time, I wish he had a more concrete program like the Environmental and Social Responsibility Amendment to the Constitution and like the Global Marshall Plan, which together, I believe, could make a huge difference in the environment.
Now, wasn't there some work in Congress towards actually trying to have a bill about the Global Marshall Plan?
Yes, and it was introduced by Congressman Keith Ellison from Minnesota, and endorsed by many, many other Congress people. But of course, in the current reality of the Republican Congress, all these good measures are in committee and will never get out of committee. So until we have a transformation in the Congress, we're not going to see very much progress on these. But on the other hand, even if they never pass, if the Global Marshall Plan doesn't pass or the Environmental and Social Responsibility Amendment to the Constitution don't pass, the struggle for them can have a very big impact. And that's why we're encouraging people to join our network of spiritual progressives and then go to local city councils, to state legislatures, legislators, to their congresspeople, as well as their civic organizations and political organizations, social change organizations, religious organizations, professional organizations, to get all of these two measures endorsed. Because the more people who come out in favor of them, the more people, other people will begin to ask themselves, yeah, maybe there's a better way to achieve homeland security than militarism. And as the Global Marshall Plan says, the way to get it is that security is through generosity and caring. And similarly with the Environmental and Social Responsibility Amendment, there's a better way to deal with the environment than simply small little steps. We have to get control of the major corporations. And so the Environmental and Social Responsibility Amendment, first of all, bans all money from elections on the state and national level except public funding. And secondly, requires every corporation with incomes above $50 million a year to get a new corporate charter once every 5 years, which they could only get if they could prove a satisfactory history of environmental and social responsibility to a panel of ordinary citizens who will in turn get testimony about the operations and the impact of those corporations from people all over the planet who are being affected by those by each particular corporation that's being reviewed as they reapply for the renewal of their corporate license.
Well, that's a fantastic idea. And it, for that to pass, we would almost need a real sense of crisis. And David Ray Griffin, who was the inspiration behind the first book that I edited, you contributed to, 9/11 and American Empire, has a new book out called Unprecedented, which I think is the best single introduction to the topic of global warming. From the perspective of what some would call the alarmist perspective, that it's a monumental issue that could destroy civilization within a couple of generations. And he talks in that book about the justice between generations issue. The Pope also brought that up in his encyclical, that the current generation is committing a crime against future generations by living in a way that's just degrading the life that will be led by future generations. And it seems you need a bit of a spiritual perspective to appreciate that, as the Pope says in his encyclical, the sort of human, the ultra-humanist technocratic mentality pretty much favors whatever is convenient for me in the here and now, and discounts future generations and discounts poor people and so on. How could we galvanize people to respond to a huge crisis, a complete threat to our civilization, if that threat isn't going to become manifest for another generation or two?
Well, that's where the role of intermediate steps come. And so the Environmental and Social Responsibility Amendment is a campaign to move people to that consciousness. I see it. The thing is, what we're up against is this high level of denial. And the high level of denial because of the depression that people are feeling about the their powerlessness to do anything. So I think we need to have some concrete steps that help people feel that they can accomplish something, but they have to be visionary enough so that they don't end up simply putting tiny little band-aids on the problem. That's why, on the one hand, I'm not, although I'm certainly in favor of getting new forms of energy for, you know, new ways of getting the sun's energy into one's house and recycling and all of those important but limited steps. I also want to see more what Andre Gorz called non-reformist reforms, steps that actually change the power balance somewhat. And that's why the ESRA becomes so important, because it allows people to address the environmental crisis, but not by imagining that they can, in one step, overthrow the whole system that has created it. So it's a major step by requiring public funding of all state and federal elections and banning all other money and requiring corporations to get a new corporate charter every 5 years, which they could only get if they could prove a satisfactory history of environmental and social responsibility to a jury of ordinary citizens. So these are intermediate steps that raise the issue, but raise the issue in a way that makes it possible for people to imagine that there's something that they could do other than despair. Because the most significant social change activists of the past 60 years, Martin Luther King Jr., did not become an icon of social change by giving a speech to hundreds of thousands of people saying, "I have a complaint." No, it was, "I have a dream. I have a vision of the world that we want to go to." And I think that this is what's been absent from much of the liberal and progressive movement that is desperately needed as a positive vision. And that's what we are doing with our network of spiritual progressives. So I urge your listeners to check us out, come to our website, and join the network of spiritual progressives at spiritualprogressives.org.
Yes, it's certainly a worthy effort. In the Pope's encyclical, he does talk about a sort of paternalism, saying, you know, God is the father of all. And that it's, you know, I'm from the Islamic tradition coming out of Unitarianism, where we are skeptical of that metaphor. And I would even argue that one of the places where Islam corrects the Jewish and Christian traditions is by saying that the father is not the right metaphor for God. And actually in Islam, the very first two words with any kind of concrete element that refer to God are Rahman, Rahim, which both come from the root for womb and connote the love of a mother for her children. So it takes the metaphor. You know, there's an argument, there's been a problem in Judaism and Christianity with a kind of patriarchal view of God.
Well, you know, first of all, that's certainly true, and secondly, it's not the whole of the picture. You know, when Moses in the Torah says to God, "Show me, please, your glory," and you know, "Reveal to me your glory," and God says, "Okay, I'll pass before you, and you'll see me from behind. You'll see how I see the world." And then the words that go are Adonai Adonai El Rachum V'Chanun, the Lord, full of mercy and justice. But the word for mercy there, full of mercy and kindness. And so, and the word for mercy or there is Rachum, and
yes, direct parallel.
Yeah, Rachma. That's where Rachmana came from in Arabic. El Rachum is from the word Rechem, which means womb. So the idea of the female energy is right there in the Torah, but it has been obscured, as it has been obscured in many variants of Islam today, which are heavily patriarchal and very, very, very much about the power over and the male power over. That's not to say that's what Islam is, but there are certainly many variants of Islam that have gone in that direction.
Right. Although I would argue that it's not so much Islam that's created that situation. One way to understand what I mean by that is when you look at this areas where women in the Islamic world are struggling for their rights, generally they're taking the kind of religious perspective and going against a kind of a tribal patriarchal perspective. You know, there are basically two real cultural currents in much of the Islamic world, which is the local tribal tradition, which is totally patriarchal. And then there's the religious tradition, which I would argue is far less patriarchal and which actually has ideals of gender equality or at least gender justice. And so we see, you know, for example, in if you go back in history during the Ottoman Empire, women quite often would be suing their husbands for complete sexual satisfaction, which they're owed in any marriage. And this, of course, would have been unthinkable in the Christian West.
Can I tell you, that same principle is in the Torah. It absolutely requires the man to give sexual satisfaction to his wife.
Right. Interesting, isn't it, that somehow that got lost to the point that in the late 19th century, the top Western scientists were still debating over whether women could even experience sexual pleasure. And today in the Islamic world, when there are disputes over things like honor killings, the honor killings are coming from a patriarchal tradition, and they happen not just among Muslims, but also among Christians from exactly the same cultures. And it's a result of tribal honor. And the countervailing cultural force is the religion. And so in these places, usually it's actually the religious people and women working through the religious tradition who are working against the honor killings. Many people don't realize this, and they slander Islam by saying that it's the religion that's causing the problem. Actually, no, the religion, I would argue, is the solution. The religion has this non-patriarchal view of God and many other very good aspects. But that gets lost because people just assume that whatever somebody who's labeled a Muslim does must be doing that bad thing because of their religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the same thing with like female circumcision. That's totally un-Islamic. And it's Islam that says don't do that, but it's the tribal patriarchal tradition, the local tradition that leads people to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm
going to have to get off.
Okay. Well, thank you. It's been a wonderful interview. It's great to reconnect with you. And I thank you for your open-mindedness, willing to engage with with crazy radical Muslim conspiracy theorists like me and to contribute to my books and to take, you know, you've taken a lot of flack for that. And I think, you know, you're basically exhibiting a lot of courage and genuine independence of thought and willingness to face the world in a very, you know, beautiful and undefended way and espouse your ideals honestly. And I really appreciate that. I love your work, and I hope that these initiatives that you're pushing have the most success.
Well, thank you. As you know, I don't fully share all the conspiracy theory views that appeared in that book or in subsequent books, but I do think that the mainstream accounts are wildly insufficient and raise many, many questions that they have never been willing to answer.
Hear, hear. Okay, well, thank you so much, Rabbi Michael Lerner of Spiritual Progressives. I do, and Tikkun. I hope to possibly connect with you. I'm going to be on a book tour in the Bay Area in mid to late July, and I'll let you know about that. And
great.
Until then, God bless you.
Thank you. Many blessings to you too. And if you have that email from Gray Griffin, I'd like to be in contact with him.
Yes, I'll pass you David Ray Griffin's email. Okay, thank you. Bye.
Well, I'm a traveling light, baby, come on and go with me. Well, I'm a traveling light, baby, come on and go with me. Eight wide and seven long as rivers empties into the deep blue sea.
some fun. Got a long road to travel, come on, baby, let's have some fun.
Hi, this is Kevin Barrett, your host here at Truth Jihad Radio. And don't you know that I've got a long road to travel? That's right. This summer I'm continuing my Charlie Hebdo book tour, which has already been to Fairfield, Iowa, Des Moines, Kansas City, St. Louis, Detroit, not Toronto, because I was turned back by the border guards. They won't let me into Canada. Well, they're going to let me into Canada next time. We just had to clear up a little misunderstanding. And now I'm going to be heading out in mid-July to do talks in Denver, Berkeley, California, Sacramento, Santa Cruz, San Francisco, Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Washington, Vancouver, BC, and then on over to the beautiful province of Alberta, where I'll be visiting the at least four cities in Alberta, including Calgary, Edmonton, and a couple of others. I'm also going to be in Atlanta, Georgia, somewhere in early August. All of those dates are available at my Truth Jihad blog. Just go to truthjihad.blogspot.com to get a rundown on the long road to travel, that is the Charlie Hebdo speaking tour that will be transpiring between roughly July 18th or 20th on through about August 20th. Once again, that's the Charlie Hebdo book tour. You can find that also by going to wearenotcharliehebdo.blogspot.com and following the links. We are not Charlie Hebdo. No spaces, no punctuation, all run together. We are not charliehebdo.blogspot.com. And then just click on the link to the book tour and see if you can catch me during my West Coast tour with a brief interlude flying over to Atlanta. I do hope to see you. We're going to be talking about all kinds of false flags, not just the Charlie Hebdo false flag. So check it out, the Charlie Hebdo book tour. Go to the Truth Jihad blog, truthjihad.blogspot.com, or else just go to wearenotcharliehebdo.blogspot.com and click on the tour link. Hope to see you somewhere out west.
We'll take Route 66 and drive as long as it lasts. And when the gas gets low, we'll stop and get some more. When the gas gets low, we'll stop and get some more. Got a long road to travel and I need you by my side, you know. Called the land of dreams, heading for the city that's called the land of dreams. It's my hometown and the destination is dear old New Orleans. Where do I love and by the moonlight lip in the shadow lip? Do I love and by the moonlight lip in the shadow lip? Fine body to make you comfy while you're rocky blue away.
Too. wanna be treated this way. Going where the water tastes like wine. Going where the water tastes like wine. Going where the water tastes like wine. Wanna be treated this way. Going down the road, feeling bad.
Treat it, they're so funny.
stay.